Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. I'm back from my desert travels, and I'll tell you more about that next week. Since I left, Ken Lane released two more episodes of Desert Oracle Radio, and I like to keep you up to date, so we'll play those today. On April 26, 2024, Ken released Materia Medica on expedition with botanist surgeon John Milton Bigelow. We'll also hear about George Orwell and the Mac and Ken's insights on rural cultures. Enjoy.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, and it has been a strange springtime so far. 2 months of springtime remain, which is a nice thought. We've had a lot of rain, a lot of cold, a lot of wind. Not too much in the wildflower department. I was on the road last week, in part to eulogize my old friend Mojo Nixon down in San Diego, and the hillsides on the way were just covered in poppies and other such bursts of color. Through a lot of Riverside and North San Diego counties. Out here in the desert, it's been pretty scraggly, other than some nice bunches of my roadside favorites, the desert dandelions. Along the highways and sandy dirt roads, yellow dellos, as they are sometimes called by me. One thing I've rarely seen in these parts is a great big lupine growing in a desert wash where I've often taken my daily walks over these past how many decades? Too many. Too many years in one place. And the road can't fix that. But when you get away from all the charming people, get out walking by yourself, get out of ear range of the sirens and the monster trucks and the military aircraft. When you're still finding new ways to go this way or that way, even a dreary day can have its moments. Like coming across a big lupine, or being there when the Paris Nolina stalks are just growing out. A dozen years ago, my friend Barney and I sat down alongside a trail with our lunch a little south of here, and we watched the flower plume rising before our eyes. We caught it just in time on the day of ascension. That was probably Bigelow's Nolina with the big, big stalks, 7 or 8 feet tall. It's got one of those funny Latin names that just sounds fake. Which Nolina is that, Barney? The one with the big, big flower plume? I just love that big Nolina. Oh, well, that's the Nolina Bigelovi. Nolina Bigelovi, that's the real name in Latin. But who is Bigelow? Well, it's not Ruth C. Bigelow, who started a tea company in Connecticut in 1945. There's good tea, too, although the name on my usual Earl Grey tea, which I order by the restaurant-sized carton, is Twinings. And it's not Robert Bigelow, the motel magnate out of Las Vegas, who sometimes funds various ghost hunting and flying saucer organizations of dubious everything. It's a name that every field biologist in California should know by heart. John Milton Bigelow. As a doctor and surgeon in the 1800s on a number of important surveys of the American West, and especially along the new U.S.-Mexican border, John Milton Bigelow indulged his particular interest in native plants with medicinal uses. John Milton Bigelow was born to a seventh-generation New England family, but was raised and schooled in Ohio, where he received his medical degree in 1832 and developed his love of botany, ranging over the Ohio River Valley and its rich natural bounty. His survey of Ohio's medicinal plants was the first to be published. Having grown up poor and needing to teach school on the side to pay for college, John Milton Bigelow did not shy away from hard work or from challenges or adventure, which he gladly accepted when the chance came up. So at the age of 46, he signed on as surgeon and botanist for the Mexican Boundary Survey. Following the U.S.-Mexican War that fulfilled the gold-hungry manifest destiny of the Americans, this adventure took him through the Chihuahuan, Sonoran, and Colorado deserts, where he cataloged the great variety of desert plants. Along with a couple of other botanists on the expedition, including C.C. Perry, namesake of Perry's Nolina. The work was so pleasing to Bigelow that he readily accepted the position of botanist on another trek to plot a railroad line between the 35th and 36th parallels. Now, this is from Bigelow's biography by the British Natural History Museum. The Pacific Railroad Expedition followed a line from Fort Smith, Arkansas, to the Mojave Desert in southwestern California, and finally to Los Angeles. Although by far the oldest member of the expedition, Bigelow was a general favorite and was described in the diary of the expedition artist Baldwin Mulhausen as a pattern of gentleness and patience always, never wanting when a hearty laugh or a good joke was to be heard. To his patients, he was kind and attentive. And he made an absolute spoiled child of his mule, Billy. Leaving the party in San Diego at the end of the expedition, Bigelow continued on his own to Northern California and was one of the first botanists to see living stands of Sequoia Dendron Giganteum, the giant sequoias. As the California botanist Willis Lynn Jepson wrote, Bigelow was so fortunate as to view a considerable part of California while its native vegetation was still in nearly pristine freshness. During that beautiful spring of 1854, Bigelow ranged up the coast and across the Central Valley and deep into the Sierra Nevada. A year and a half before Galen Clark, longtime guardian of the Yosemite Grant, first laid eyes on the Mariposa Grove. In all, more than 60 plant species were first collected and described by Dr. Bigelow. He continued to take on botany expeditions well into old age. Settled in Michigan, where he was a founder of the Detroit Academy of Medicine, and was surgeon in charge of the Detroit Marine Hospital until his retirement at age 70 in 1873. It was while working on his farm 4 years later that John Milton Bigelow was fatally injured, passing on at the age of 74, deeply loved by family and friends, well remembered by all the great scientists of his time. What a life.
Desert Oracle Radio.
It's a life that's really free for the taking, too. Instead of looking at video on a screen of somebody else doing something or pretending to do something, you can be the person who does things. Not for a camera, but in real life. It's worth noting that there are no pictures of John Milton Bigelow. Although his scientific colleagues are all represented by either illustrations or photographs. Don't worry, I'm not going to take away your phone camera and your laptop. Not yet. But what if you watched 90% less video on a phone, on a screen, on the TV that now watches you as much as the phone does? As George Orwell foresaw 75 years ago when he published 1984. Some people call it 1984, but that's incorrect. It was supposed to sound cold and clinical and modern, cruelly bureaucratic, constantly humiliating. Like the emails from your health insurance corporation with subject lines like your medical claim journey regarding a life-saving prescription you've been denied by a computer program that denies medical claims in bulk by the thousands. No AI required. Back in the 80s, it was a popular thing to say that Orwell was wrong about the year 1984, but his title was never meant to be an exact prediction. It was just close enough to the book's contemporary readers, yet far enough out from 1949 to work the way it worked on people, on the culture. And it turns out George Orwell, Eric Blair in real life, timed it pretty well because he was in the zone when he wrote that book. He went out to the haunted Scottish Isle of Jura and the Hebrides, and for three seasons, usually from late spring to early autumn, he was in that charged realm of isolation, solitude, and the sea. Sick with the tuberculosis that would kill him a year and a half later. Orwell only settled on his title while pounding out his last draft on that raw Hebridean isle at a farm called Barnhill dating back to the 15th century. No newspapers, no phone, and clean sea air for his ravaged lungs. Poisoned by the pollution of London. A certain kind of book functions as a divination tool, and I've got bookcases full of them. The symbols will resonate in many ways for a long time. And so George Orwell foresaw that 1984 would be the year of the Mac. The Macintosh. Named after a Canadian apple discovered by a Scottish farmer. The new personal computer that would lead directly to the constant surveillance most of us live under every day. While we work, while we sleep, while we do whatever we do with our time. which is no business of anyone else in a society that has always prized its liberty, while steadily giving it up. From the first Macintosh desktop computer to the first computers with a built-in camera pointed at you, well, that's another 15 years or so. Beyond that year of the Mac, 1984, when Apple Computer spent a fortune on a Super Bowl commercial that announced the beginning of Big Brother while pretending to be against it. The TVs did not watch you until you started watching TV on devices that watch you back. And we did not start carrying those TVs that watch us everywhere we go until the Mac OS became the iPhone OS. So Orwell was right. With Apple Computer bizarrely playing its own mass televised role in the prediction. The Apple of 1984 was the Apple the Book of Genesis pretends existed in the earthly paradise. And yet, unlike the Book of Genesis, the bummer version of the Garden of Eden ancient story that survived, while happier versions became the realm of archaeology, our fate is not sealed. We are not forever excluded from the earthly paradise. It's still there, and it needs us to make sure it's still there. As the mountaineer Jesus of Galilee said, "The kingdom of heaven is here with us, but people do not see it." Sometimes people get mad because they listen to this broadcast and they don't like something they hear. But that's the mindset of today. If everything and everybody doesn't 100% agree with your worldview, the worldview you got off social media in place of developing your own personality, well, there's gonna be trouble. Over the years, I've come across angry emails, online messages, podcast reviews, whatever form of digital screaming, and sometimes it goes like this. "You think life was better before? Insert whatever terrible corporate military intelligence technology forced into our lives in recent years." My answer, which I never actually provide because one should never talk back to the void of misery, is yes, I think that. For more than three centuries, all the way until the 1940s, my various ancestors were all rural people living in the mountains, the deserts, the forest. They built and owned their plain rustic homes. They were unhindered by telephone and television. They breathed clean air, raised and hunted their own food, traded surplus with neighbors and in nearby towns. Their schools and cemeteries and churches were likewise built and operated by the people in that community. Where a few hundred might be spread over 1,000 square miles. Babies were born at home and people died at home, generally in old age after a full, vigorous life. Their lives were filled with music, not the banality of the algorithm generated by billionaires, but music sung and played by the people themselves. Whistle while you work. Raise your voices on Sunday mornings. Bring out the fiddles and flutes and banjos on warm evenings outside. The brass band on holidays. Mournful songs at the graveside. Oh, but somebody complains. But they did not have modern medicine. Well, that depends, doesn't it? John Milton Bigelow, whom we talked about a little while ago, was part of the long tradition of materia medica, the term for medicinal cures from the plant world, a term used from the Roman Empire to the 20th century. One of his modern medicines that he developed in Detroit was a particular version of opium that is still pretty popular worldwide, although it's now more often associated with the deaths of despair epidemic, a truly modern epidemic. Only since the 1940s has pharmacology replaced the lovely old Latin materia medica. In those olden times, people died for many reasons. But nobody died waiting for a type 2 diabetes insulin prescription because they couldn't afford it, or because the health insurance network was taken down by ransomware 3 months ago. Deaths of despair, the fastest rising cause of death in 21st century America and much of the industrialized world, were all but unknown outside the filthy, teeming cities where you only lived if you absolutely had to. We've all been sold a false bill of goods regarding the discoveries of penicillin and antibiotics and all that. Yes, they were great discoveries by brilliant scientists who never tired of learning from the natural processes of nature, of biology. And yes, they were of great use once humanity became increasingly penned up into filthy, dehumanizing tenements and poorhouses, the first fruits of the Industrial Revolution. But the outright fiction that humans and our bipedal brothers were helpless in the face of common infection has poisoned our minds like the microplastics and forever chemicals lodged in our brains today. Humans and our close relatives over these past 3 million years have always treated sickness from the same natural bounty that fed, clothed, and housed us. More than half of all the drugs you wait in line for at the Walgreens are derived from ancient cures that the local healer would have concocted from trees and herbs and cactus and minerals like countless generations before. It's why the world's immensely profitable big pharma companies are unlikely champions of saving at least some biodiverse wilderness. From the Amazonian jungles and Malaysian isles to the Siberian forest and Mexican deserts. Tomorrow's supposed new medical discovery is usually an ancient cure that people have forgotten about, as they were pushed out of the natural world and into the artificial everything debt prisons of modern life. And the very miracle cures from Louis Pasteur on down have turned into a sick nightmare in less than a century of widespread use. Bacterial infections, once controlled with little more than clean air and pure water and wild honey packed over a wound, have become Dr. Frankenstein's superbugs. Impossible to control. Untreatable. Resistant to the harshest antibiotics the industry can synthesize. When you spend a lifetime eating factory-produced meat and eggs and dairy pumped full of antibiotics to fight the filth and misery the animals live out their pathetic lives imprisoned within, then common infections and once rare conditions become common killers. Before the nightmare became daylight reality for most of us less than a century ago, at the time when the sickened George Orwell typed his masterpiece between bloody fits of coughing, few people ever stepped foot into a doctor's office or were rolled into an operating room to have limbs amputated due to epidemic type 2 diabetes, which was all but unknown. This is from a 2016 study of pre-industrial chronic disease from the National Institutes of Health. Quote, Converging evidence suggests that hunter-gatherers, horticulturalists, and agropastoralists living under relatively traditional conditions do not experience coronary artery disease or type 2 diabetes. It is unlikely that clinically relevant heart disease and type 2 diabetes were ever frequent causes of morbidity and mortality among older adults in pre-industrialized societies. Lifestyle factors such as lean, high-fiber diets free of processed foods, higher levels of physical activity, minimal smoking, and other behaviors are protective factors common to many pre-industrial societies. Infant and childhood mortality was always high in pre-industrial society. The Amish in 18th century America were typical, losing about 1 in 5 children to infections and illness and birth defects. Today, as diverse and cascading factors from BPA contamination of sperm to childcare being unaffordable to all but the highest earners, has sent human fertility plummeting to levels never before seen in the human race. Instead of 4 in 5 of your children surviving to adulthood, or even half your children surviving to adulthood and old age, you can't afford to have any children. And the world is so demeaning and depressing that most young people don't want to have children. They think it's their own decision, although E.O. Wilson could set them straight. The book is called On Human Nature, if you're interested. So the rich have 2 beautiful kids carefully raised to get 20 years of increasingly expensive schooling where any free-thinking protest behavior is dealt with in truly Orwellian fashion. And then the well-trained offspring are put behind desk on Wall Street 5 days a week between 48-hour cocaine binges with hookers on yachts. The lifespan of an American has barely risen above that in the Old Testament, supposedly the story of Bronze Age pastoralists 5 millennia ago, 70 years. Boy to Zyzix across the great Mojave wilderness. This is Desert Oracle Radio, and I'm Ken Lane with soundscapes on this program by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. I'm sorry the April campfire stories never happened, and all the other things that were supposed to happen around here. There's a malevolent force around here, no use sugarcoating it, and I'm done trying. The next campfire stories will be, as I've mentioned, in the Eastern Sierra, or just a handful of you who might be up there. Details to come in time. Don't get nervous about it. Don't get nervous about anything like this. Just don't worry about it. And don't worry, I'm not going to take away your spreadsheets and your video conferences. I leave that to the forces already at work, already taking down global infrastructure, its poisoned heart and crumbling bones. Be of good cheer. The military-industrial state will soon collapse. I used to laugh at that Ed Abbey's line from down the river. I'm not laughing anymore. Good night from the Voice of the Desert.
Well, someday I hope to be able to attend one of Ken's live appearances. Not this time, but I can report some warm temperatures in Death Valley from my visit. Be patient. Spring will bring a couple warm days to us before summer sets in. We are at the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. Our second episode today is titled Funeral for a Raven. Released May 3rd, 2024, Ken says, tonight we're talking ravens, fishes, and loaves, and the soul-crushing indoor indoctrination of the empire's state religion. Sir James George Frazer, Pliny the Elder, and the Gospel Mark are all involved, whether they like it or not. Enjoy.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, straight into darkness. Although, to be perfectly honest, it's still daylight as I am making this episode for you. So if you hear all the joyful songbirds somewhere in the background, well, that's not a red, blue, black, silver sound effect. That's the real thing. One thing I've noticed in getting older is that the people who ritually and regularly consume news media, especially the relics of monolithic media, nightly cable news, daily New York Times, etc., well, they all seem to have brain worms, worms in the brain, eating up the gray matter, leaving little behind. These ritual consumers of media have conversations that are mostly about what's bad that they heard on the news and always have some either-or response to whatever issue from the two choices given. And by the luck of their own generational draw, they have a comfortable retirement, so they don't experience most of daily life for people of working age. Their entertainment is the collapse of the world they once knew. And they pick their sides based on what their favorite newsreader reads off the teleprompter on a video screen. Of course, it can all change in an instant, but the audience rarely notices. Most disturbingly, some of these news consumers are fans or stans of particular news personalities. Like somebody who was on PBS and died 10 years ago, that sort of thing. But also, what's her name on this or that cable channel? What a newsreader. I really like her. That's what my mother once said about a catatonic newsreader on that very slow-paced TV news show for seniors. I really like her. That's a sign of brainworms, I'm sorry to say. To even have personal thoughts about a TV newsreader, it's clinical evidence of parasitic brainworms. As crystal clear, a brainworm situation as a millennial customer care representative working from home with $50,000 in credit card bills from buying all the vinyl copies of all the Taylor Swift reissues. Despite not owning a turntable. And that's a true fact about most vinyl record sales today. Most vinyl record sales go to people who don't own turntables, but one day they'll have the space and some more credit. And that's what a life without meaning looks like. This is what a meaningless society looks like. Just waking up in the morning makes you complicit. Oh, and last week the iPhone company admitted that it somehow broke the clocks within millions of iPhones. So people's alarms did not go off. Many people surely lost jobs or got in various forms of bureaucratic trouble, missed their weekly video phone appointment, forgot to pick up the cat from the vet, whatever. Apple Computer managed to break the clock in the phone remotely. Really a Boeing moment for the evil little devices. We never needed a mark of the beast. We willingly carry it around and pay for the privilege. So it's no wonder the more thoughtful and or romantic and or brave college kids have looked at the absolute evil in the world, primarily funded and committed by their own country, and decided to stand up for something during that one brief moment in their life when they've maybe got the vim and vigor necessary to put up a fight. At least once, this one time. Before being beaten back down and receiving their re-education and returning with glassy eyes and shattered nerves to their rotting society with its collapsing bridges and starving people and 600,000 homeless crowding the streets. As everything heats up a little more every year, and even the boomers are losing their homeowners insurance and even their spacious homes to the constant climate disasters, where a drooling corpse propped up at a podium can, on a whim, in final furious burst of senile insanity, either start World War III or release selected thousands of adults from lifelong debt bondage, or conversely, make entire graduating classes personas non grata, unable to get jobs or even the citizen's identification number, unable to qualify for the housing vouchers, unable to line up for rations at the USDA food bank every second Thursday. Well, you can't make a brainworm omelet without cracking a few skulls, as they say in the violence training program at all our Pentagon-funded local police departments. Speaking of state violence against peace activists, last year I recorded a podcast with a couple of guys and then I forgot all about it. And then this week, they posted the episode. We discuss the Gospel of Mark, specifically Mark chapter 8. The show is called, Bible Friends, apparently. And I've always been a friend of the Bible, because it's a classic book from antiquity, especially in the King James translation, is a treasury of the English language. And unfortunately, it's one of the few works that has survived from antiquity, because the imperial theocracy that assembled the Holy Bible also made sure to destroy almost all evidence of other books, of other art, of poetry, of anything that celebrated the beauty and wonder of life on earth. The only life we'll ever know. The only home we'll ever know. It was in the year 313 that the evil Constantine signed the Edict of Milan, making the monotheistic cult of the Christians the favored state religion in the vast empire he ruled as dictator for life. As Hans Pulsander wrote in The Emperor Constantine, the prevailing spirit of Constantine's government was one of conservatism. His conversion to and support of Christianity served an entirely conservative end, the preservation and continuation of the empire. Constantine did not even believe in the religion. His was a deathbed conversion, just in case.
Desert Oracle Radio.
just in case that monotheistic prison he'd built represented something more than an easy way to crush his rivals, crush dissent and innovation. The Roman Empire did not die for lack of power, for lack of cruelty and might. It died because people quit believing in it. They only believed in death. The monotheistic cult that Constantine elevated to sole state religion created a population of gloomy morons who despised their own lives, who despised the beauty and pleasure and adventure of human existence, who despised joy and clung to fear and dread. Climate change, lead in the water, the collapse of human fertility, the daylight corruption, all of this contributed to that empire's supposedly impossible collapse. But it was the immersive evil of monotheism that drowned the elderly empire and its credulous, moronic masses. As Gibbon makes clear in his History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, published in the year of 1776, a missed opportunity for a real revolution. Although we are getting there. Anyway, here's a clip from the Bible Friends podcast, which you can hear in its entirety, if you like, by looking it up on your phone or visiting the Desert Oracle radio website. We will probably have a link to it on the radio page.
Well, we've gotten up to chapter 8 in our journey.
We're in a desert.
We're out there. We've got a bunch of people gathered. And this has happened before in Mark, that they don't have enough food. And somehow they managed to divide the loaves.
Yeah, I have some feelings about that as an editor.
Lay them on. You going to cut that, or you think there's some power to the reputation?
I'm certainly not the first to say it. I mean, every movie version, they always combine those into one event.
Yeah.
And when I look at it, it seems to be, there must be some symbolic meaning to it. It's like, why would, and you know, also Jesus, sorry, Lord, but that explanation of the parable is terrible. Where he's saying, you know, where it ends with, and because it's this number and this number. It's like, what?
Yeah.
I don't, let me tell you what part I'm talking about. It's 8:14, the yeast of the Pharisees and Herod. I think I'm reading the New English Translation here. Now, they had forgotten to take bread, except for one loaf they had with them in the boat, and Jesus ordered them, "Watch out, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of Herod." So they began to discuss with one another about having no bread. When he learned of this, Jesus said to them, "Why are you arguing about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Have your hearts been hardened? Though you have eyes, don't you see? And though you have ears, can't you hear? Don't you remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of pieces did you pick up? 12. When I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many baskets full of pieces did you pick up?" They replied, 7. Then he said to them, "Do you still not understand? Do you guys understand that?
And does that mean nothing to you?" Jesus says, and I kind of have to say, yeah, I'm not sure. Fred, you probably looked into the scholarship here. What's going on?
The empire, which created the entire religion people know as Christianity, did its best to crush the troublesome parts of the Jesus movement. The entirety of Jesus' philosophy, I mean. Because Jesus of Galilee, known simply as Yeshua ben Yosef in his own time, was in rebellion against the empire. His entire ministry was a rebellion against the weak and corrupt Roman-era urban temple religion. He, like Abraham and Moses and David before him, conducted his religious work outside in the natural places charged with old magic. Rivers and seashores, desert wilderness, rugged mountaintops. And when death was at hand, did Jesus return to that nest of vipers, the great urban temple that looked no different than an imperial cult temple in any other backwoods province? With its corrupt priests and politicians and the soldiers loitering around everywhere looking for some heads to crack? Of course not. He went to the ancient sacred grove upon the Mount of Olives. And there in the night he spoke directly to his God, the All-Father. Abba, as Jesus called the greatest of the regional gods. The personal form of Father, Papa, Dad. Everybody called their greatest gods by those ancient names, Mother and Father. Although Constantine and his successors followed the lead of his rabidly insane mother Helena, especially in destroying the old places of outdoor worship, the high places throughout Palestine, just as the old European holy groves were cut down from the time of Caesar to Charlemagne, it turns out that this imperial dictatorship with its slave religion control system could not make every piece of the great ancient ages disappear. There were too many copies of the great works, Homer and Herodotus, Aristotle and Aesop. Remember that 97% of the great ancient works are lost to us, intentionally destroyed for the most part. Yet that tiny fraction of surviving texts was enough to fuel the great burst of scholarship, archaeology, anthropology, and art that overturned the old imperial church's stranglehold. The stranglehold on thought, on knowledge, on wisdom. And so, over time, it has been revealed that the urban temple form of imperial religious control was a fraud, something constructed by the Lord of Lies. Which is why, if you look at those cheap old houses' social media accounts, you'll see that entire churches are available for sale throughout the United States and much of the world. For sale and for peanuts. There are no gods in such places. Only the local spirits of sadness, of death, of cracked stucco, faded plastic siding, collapsed bell towers, broken windows, and Sunday schools with no children, no one left to lie to. Speaking of, there is a hot news story coming out of New Orleans. The Archdiocese of Orleans Parish is under criminal investigation running a widespread, decades-long child sex trafficking ring. Anyway, I recently came across an old book called Folklore in the Old Testament, Volume 3, a lesser-known work by the pioneering Scottish anthropologist and folklorist Sir James George Fraser, who is rightly famed for his immense work of world mythology and folklore, The Golden Bough, published in various lengthy and condensed versions between 1890 and 1936. The great work that begins, of course, with the eternal legend of Diana of the Woods, Diana of the Sacred Grove, Diana of the Mirror Lake, Diana of the Yellow Moon. So let me read a little from this other work, Folklore in the Old Testament, Volume 3, because it's very much within our range of interest here at Desert Oracle Radio, about the life we once lived before the dark times, before the empire. There was was a special propriety in the employment of ravens to minister to the prophet in the wilderness. For the raven has often been regarded as a bird of omen and even as itself endowed with prophetic power. Thus, the Greeks esteemed the bird sacred to Apollo, the god of prophecy. And Greek augurs drew omens from its croaking. Moreover, persons who desired to gain the power of divination used to eat the hearts of ravens, believing that they thereby acquired the raven's prophetic soul. That's incorrect. Don't do that. Editor's note. The Romans thought that a raven stalking up and down on the sands and croaking was calling for rain. Also simplistic. Dumb. In some parts of Europe, the raven is still deemed ominous of death. The Indians of British Columbia imagine that he who has a raven for his guardian spirit possesses the gift of prophecy, and that he can especially foretell death and the weather. Indeed, the raven is the principal figure in the mythology current among the Indian tribes of northwestern America. The sagacity and solemn deportment of this sable bird may have had much to do with throwing a glamour of mystery and sanctity about it. According to an eminent authority, the raven is, quote, probably the most highly developed of all birds. Quick-sighted, sagacious, and bold. It must have followed the prehistoric fisher and hunter and generally without molestation from them, to prey on the refuse of their spoils, just as it now waits, with the same intent, on the movements of their successors. While it must have likewise attended the earliest herdsmen, who could not have regarded it with equal indifference, since its now notorious character for attacking and putting to death a weakly animal was doubtless in those days too manifested. Yet the raven is no mere dependent upon man, being always able to get a living for itself, and moreover, a sentiment of veneration or superstition is from very remote ages and among many races of people attached to it. A sentiment so strong as often to overcome the feeling of distrust, not to say of hatred, which its deeds inspired, and though rapidly decreasing, even to survive in some places until the present time. Pliny the Elder tells a story which strikingly illustrates the veneration in which the raven was popularly held at Rome, when Rome was at the height of her glory. Under the reign of Tiberius, it happened that a pair of ravens had built their nest on the roof of the temple of Castor and Pollux. One of the young birds in time flew down, stalked into a shoemaker's shop, and took up its quarters there, the shoemaker not venturing to molest a creature which he looked upon with religious awe. Partly, perhaps, for its own sake, and partly for the sake of the holy place where it had been hatched. Every morning, the sagacious bird flew out of the shop, perched on the rostra in the forum, and there, in a distinct voice, saluted the emperor and his two sons, Drusus and Germanicus, by name. After which he greeted in an affable manner the people passing to their business. Having discharged these offices of civility, he returned to the shop. This he continued to do for many years, till at last another shoemaker in the neighborhood killed the bird, either out of spite, as was suspected, the custom which the raven brought to his rival, or, as the shoemaker himself alleged, in a fit of passion because the bird had befouled the shoes in his shop. Whatever the motive, it was a bad day's work for him, for the people, thunderstruck at the death of their old favorite, rose in their wrath, drove the corbicidal shoemaker from his shop and never rested till they had the miscreant's blood. As for the dead raven, it received a public funeral, which was attended by thousands. The casket was supported on the shoulders of two Ethiopians. A flute player marched in front, discoursing solemn music, while wreaths of flowers of all sorts carried in the procession testified to the general respect and sorrow for the deceased. In this impressive manner, the funeral cortege made its way to the pyre, which had been erected 2 miles out on the Appian Way. The historian concludes by remarking that the bird received a grander funeral than many a prince before him. Oh, and that raven funeral story is so good, I never got to chapter 15, Sacred Oaks. For instance, it quotes W.M. Thompson's book, The Land and the Book, Lebanon, Damascus, and Beyond Jordan. Traveling in northern Palestine, Thompson remarks, "These oaks under which we now sit are believed to be inhabited by jinn and other spirits. Almost every village in these wadis and on those mountains has one or more of such thick oaks, which are sacred from the same superstition. Many of them in the region are believed to be inhabited by certain spirits called Benat Yaqab, daughters of Jacob, a strange and obscure notion in regard to which I could never obtain an intelligible explanation." Return to this. Return to lines such as, "Scarcely any tree figures more largely in biblical narrative and poetry than the oak. In a village in northern Syria, there is a large and very old oak tree which is regarded as sacred. People burn incense to it and bring their offerings to it precisely in the same way as to some shrine. But there is no tomb of any saint in the neighborhood. The people worship the tree itself. From Amboy to Zizix and across the great Mojave wilderness, you've been listening to Desert Oracle Radio with some new soundscapes throughout this program by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. We're on the radio sometimes in Joshua Tree at 10. But you're listening to the podcast, and the radio is not going to get that for another week. Another cold front coming through. Very strong winds in the desert. Be careful, or it might blow your wig off. Thank you for listening. And good night from the voice of the desert.
My deep thanks to Ken Lane for his work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thank you, Gallatin Valley, and everyone for listening. Please call and leave me a message or text about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246. You can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org. at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle replay episodes are also available on demand on the KGBN.org website. Till next week, stay well and sweet dreams. Coldplay takes us out today with Life in Technicolor from their album Viva La Vida, or Death and All His Friends.